It's time once again for Dialogue Conspiracy with May Brussel. For the past 14 years, May has been researching and uncovering facts and evidence from between the lines of the news and placing them in a more thorough perspective of how conspiracy, political assassination, and abuses of power affect us all. Dialogue Conspiracy originates with KLRB-FM in Carmel, California. And now, May Brussel.
Start all over. Okay, here we go again. General chaos in the room tonight. It's May Brussel, Carmel, California. It's Dialogue Conspiracy number 292, and this is October the 23rd, 1977. I mentioned a few weeks ago a lawsuit or several lawsuits that are involved with the Howard Hughes Corporation, the Summa Corporation, and the persons that controlled the body of Howard Hughes, and particularly that story of the drugging of Howard Hughes and the subpoena that was going to be served to the doctors of Howard Hughes. It seems that they had administered drugs that required prescriptions in the name of the recipient, and they didn't use Howard Hughes' name, which was illegal, and these doctors will be called before a grand jury. I also mentioned that Johnny Meyer, who was a former employee of Howard Hughes, had said to me on the telephone when I talked to him that many people involved with the Hughes organization would be killed as these lawsuits proceed, and a lot of heads would start falling. And as soon as he had said that, I don't think it was a week later, when there was a murder attempt on Jack Eggers. And I have mentioned Jack Eggers on other programs on Dialogue Conspiracy. He happens to still be alive, but his story is interesting, and we'll have to follow that case. Bobby Hall was murdered last year right after Howard Hughes, or the alleged person Howard Hughes, was buried in Houston, Texas. And Bobby Hall had a pharmacy in Hollywood, California. He was a big supplier of drugs in Hollywood for stars, starlets, famous politicians, and military people. He was the source of contracts by drugging various people through blackmail and shenanigans in Hollywood. Worked closely with the Hughes organization. And he also was a close friend of Jack Eggers, the captain of the Beverly Hills Police Department, the man who was in total control of Howard Hughes' body when he began to be heavily doped from 1957 to 1966, the period where Howard was never seen again. And Jack Eggers' name came up at the time that Bobby Hall was murdered, because two men, Gene LaBelle and Jack Ginsburg, had called the captain of the Beverly Hills Police Department, Jack Eggers, and said, "We're going to kill Bobby Hall tonight," and then they called him afterwards and said the job was accomplished. Well, now Jack Eggers was forced to resign from the Beverly Hills Police Department when his name was linked to this drug scandal and the murder of Bobby Hall and the story of Hughes breaking in the newspapers. And Jack Eggers has kept kind of out of the news, but a man came to his home just this last week at 10 o'clock Thursday night and asked for Eggers and came back and pretended he had the wrong address. And then Eggers went outside to the car, and there was a bath towel over the car license plate. So he called the police, and then the man came back in again to see Jack Eggers, and the police came shortly, and this man had the name of Jack Eggers in his wallet. His name is David Jolson. He's only 22 years old, and he had a .38 Smith Wesson pistol in the front seat, and it seems that the license plate was covered for good reason, although pretty obvious, and he's being held for a charge of attempt to murder. There'll be a lot of murders involving this case because it involves millions of dollars and possible prison terms for a lot of important people, and the story will be unfolding for years to come. But it's like the John Kennedy assassination, the series of witnesses that were murdered as soon as John Kennedy was killed, that now literally run over 100. And nobody yet has tallied the list of people that have been killed in direct connection to the Howard Hughes organization, which isn't much separate from the John Kennedy assassination, but at least even since Howard Hughes, or the body of this person, was buried in Houston. So we'll be following the news, but right after I heard that there would be some deaths, it was just a few days later, and sure enough, a murder attempt, it seems, on Jack Eggers. Jack Eggers is one of the most pivotal men in the United States on what happened to Howard Hughes from 57 to 66. And I'm sure the same people that kidnapped and drugged Hughes would hire somebody and have him eliminate him for a price to keep the story under control. Another story which is bursting to be told, but which is tightly under control, is the story of Richard Helms, who has been charged or could possibly face indictment for perjury. Now, this is a bombshell that Richard Nixon had to live with. He said, if you prosecute me at the time of Watergate, I'll tell all the seamy things I did for the White House. And Richard Nixon's administration, the former Bay of Pigs operators who've been named as having a part in the assassination of John Kennedy, of course, all worked with Richard Helms or for Richard Helms. And the Kennedy assassination and all the other murders that followed would unravel if Helms ever really was able to talk. So Jimmy Carter now is president of the United States, and he sits with a time bomb of whether or not to prosecute Richard Helms. But the men wanting to stop the prosecution are, of course, the same people that I've been naming as part of the Kennedy assassination and want to hold the line, of course. So there was an article just October the 18th, Jack Nelson, Los Angeles Times, Washington bureau chief, and it reads, "The establishment pressures the Attorney General Griffin Bell to go easy on Helms." The appeal came from journalists all over the world and politicians, from Democrats as well as Republicans, from political heavyweights such as Avril Harriman, to the former New York governor and top official in Democratic administrations, and the former Vice President Nelson Rockefeller, the New York governor and leading Republican for decades. That's interesting because I can see that Rockefeller would not want Richard Helms to talk about any of these stories. Hugh Seide from formerly Life magazine and Time magazine, and various journalists, Eric Severoid from CBS, of course, named as a CIA conduit, are blaming, are begging Jimmy Carter. There's a lot of pressure on all the news media to go easy on Helms. And, of course, the bait is that then in turn they'd probably go easy on Jimmy Carter for various things that might come up. The strength of the Associated Press, United Press, and the Eastern establishment, William E. Simon is named. He was the Treasury Secretary for Nixon and Ford. These people are all frantic, and they're saying you can't prosecute Richard Helms because I know they're afraid if they prosecute him or indict him for his perjury over the ITT scandal or the story of funding Allende when he said under sworn oath that he didn't have anything to do with the overthrow of Chile. They have a clear-cut case of perjury, but they're trying to get out on it and national security. That's the umbrella that held up the lies of the Warren Commission. Earl Warren talked about national security is a business for locking up evidence for 75 years. And there's this appeal. You can't indict a man who has had 35 years of public service. This is what Attorney Bell is saying, the Attorney General Griffin Bell, in quotes. They're telling me you can't indict a man who's had 35 years of public service. And yet there are not very many hard researchers who wouldn't say that those were the bloodiest years of service in American history. And it would be like saying you can't indict Hermann Göring or the gang around Adolf Hitler because they served him for 30 years or 20 years. It's ridiculous. Of course he should be indicted, but the pressure of people like Nelson Rockefeller is on to keep the truth from being told about the Kennedy assassination. And I'm sure that is the power block that Helms holds over all of the media and the Eastern Seaboard that he's served so well all these years. Well, there's a book out this week I want to talk about. I received it. Ted Gandolfo in New York sent me a copy. It's called Marina and Lee. It's by a woman who's worked with the CIA for years by the name of Priscilla Johnson and another woman named Marina Oswald. I don't know if I'm supposed to speak on the radio. I don't know if you're allowed to call these females bitches on the air, so I won't use that name, but they are two of the most notorious pathological liars of American history, these two that teamed up, Priscilla Johnson and Marina Oswald. They're out there working for a buck. They're selling a story that's positively untrue. Marina was threatened with U.S. citizenship being revoked if she didn't go along with this story as early as November in 1963, before the assassination took place even. And Priscilla Johnson, as I say, not only works for profit, but she works as a Cold War strategist for the State Department, and this can be documented. They know they're telling lies in this book. They're being pushed on the talk shows, but the condition is that Marina Oswald doesn't answer any questions and can't be challenged. They're getting the use of that CIA media I talked about last week. CBS, NBC will carry them. The Associated Wire Service carried the press conference. Good Morning America with Robert Hartman had Priscilla Johnson and Marina Oswald on. Candy Jones in New York, who was with the CIA and still is,
No phone calls were allowed the 5 hours of these women on the air, or at least Priscilla pushing her book. Tom Snyder, I believe it's ABC, is pushing a book of 467 pages of unadulterated lies. And the propaganda goes on and on. At the press conference that they had that was carried over all the wire services, Marina Oswald was described as expressionless. She said, when I read the book, it made me aggravated and angry at Lee. She learned more about him from Priscilla Johnson through osmosis. Priscilla must have picked it up than Marina knew. In 64, night after the assassination, she was taken, Marina Oswald, with Priscilla Johnson and spent 7 months with her, which was the seeding of this monster book, these 467 pages. And it was kept under the lid like a time bomb all this time. They described Mrs. Porter as barely changing her expression. This is Marina Oswald. And she could hardly answer some of the questions the press asked her. The one thing she said, she had a prepared statement. And she says, anyone who reads Marina and Lee will see that the events of November the 22nd, 1963, had to happen. And the press conference was covered by the Washington Post. And they added, she was unable to clarify at the press conference why the assassination had to happen. They cut it short and took her away, and I believe probably that Priscilla Johnson will be doing the touring of this book all over the country on various talk shows, and Marina Oswald will go back into her seclusion. The truth about Marina Oswald lies more with the testimony before the hearings of the Warren Commission staff and the Warren Commission themselves, the 26 volumes. Marina was the first witness. She was their primary witness. When Captain Fritz testified, he was the chief of homicide in Dallas, Texas, he testified before Joseph Ball and the Warren Commission, and he said, in quotes, that the FBI agent, James Hostey, from the Dallas-Fort Worth area, visited Marina Oswald on two occasions before John Kennedy was killed, and he testified under oath that after Lee Harvey Oswald was in his office, in Captain Fritz's office, the afternoon that John Kennedy was killed, Oswald met FBI agent in the office, and he accused him not only of threatening his wife, but he suggested, according to Captain Frist's testimony, that Marina Oswald was told that she would have to go back to Russia. And this was November the 1st, 1963. And Lee Harvey Oswald was saying that November 22nd, 1963. Now, I didn't think the FBI had the capacity of being the State Department of deporting her. It's not a part of the Immigration Service. Marina Oswald hadn't broken any laws. She wasn't on any list November the 1st. Lee Harvey Oswald wasn't on any list of subversives. Why was the FBI offering her the chance, or the threat, as it seemed, to terrorize her, to say, you have to go back to Russia? This was November the 1st. Now, Lee Harvey Oswald recorded that conversation. He wrote a letter that's in volume 16, page 33 of the Warren Commission hearings, dated November the 9th. That was 9 days after the FBI agent Hostey visited Marina Oswald, and he said to the Russian embassy in Washington, D.C., the FBI visited here in Dallas, Texas. James Hostey suggested to Marina that she could remain in the United States under FBI protection if she cooperated, and she could defect, he said, from the Soviet Union. I and my wife strongly protested the tactics by the notorious FBI. And then he gives information about his new daughter being born. Now, that seems like a contradiction, that before the assassination, Lee Harvey Oswald was complaining that the FBI was with his wife, telling her that she could stay in the United States and they'd protect her. And the day of the assassination, the FBI had told her that they were going to deport her. But the date that James Hostey visited Marina Oswald is an interesting date, because it was November the 1st, 1963, and that's the day that John Kennedy was supposed to be killed in Chicago. And a man named Lee Harvey Oswald, or at least the name Oswald, was on a license plate that was going to be used for the getaway. There were three plans to kill John Kennedy that are known about in the United States and can be documented very carefully in terms of weapons and names and operation. One was in Florida a few weeks before the assassination in Dallas, and just a week or so before he was supposed to go to Chicago. They got wind of the assassination plans, and he was taken in a helicopter to the building and not in a motorcade. John Kennedy was supposed to be killed in Chicago, and the weapons were later confiscated. The game, his visit to the football game was called off because that was the weekend that Diem was murdered in Southeast Asia, and Kennedy went right to Washington and didn't go to the football game. So the third place for the killing was going to be Dallas, Texas, and they took it off 22 days later. It's interesting that the name Oswald was going to be used in Chicago, and the name Oswald comes up on November the 1st. When that assassination attempt didn't go through, it seems that James Hostie was talking to Marina Oswald, and maybe it had more to do with the plans moving to Dallas then, and threatening her that if they don't go along with the next action in Dallas, Texas, and this would be the one, she would be deported. And if she cooperated, she would have the protection of the FBI, which she got, and the citizenship, which she got, and the State Department then did go along with Agent Hostie said. So there was no inconsistency in what Lee Harvey Oswald said happened before and happened in the letters. I brought with me a few memos on Marina Oswald that were working papers of the Warren Commission staff. One of them, I believe, I read on KLRB a couple of years ago, but because this book is coming out, Marina and Lee, I wanted to read them again. One is by David W. Bellin of the Warren Commission staff, who was the chief investigator for the Rockefeller Committee when they were supposed to be looking into the CIA, and he did a dismal job. David Bellin wrote to Mr. J. Lee Rankin, the general counsel of the Warren Commission, January the 29th, 1964, because Marina was testifying and had told so many lies. And he said, in reviewing the questions for Marina Oswald that we discussed, there are three basic reasons for our suggestion of a polygraph test of Marina Oswald. First, a substantial portion of key testimony so far as Marina said, is not subject to the ordinary task of credibility. It wouldn't pass the task of credibility. Two, as far as the public is concerned, we should submit her to a polygraph examination, Marina Oswald, before our final publication to get the report out. And three, if under polygraph examination it were being shown that Marina Oswald had not been truthful in her testimony, it would throw an entirely new light on aspects of the investigation. Now, the investigation was a total failure for all the subjects that are in the book, Marina and Lee, because they turned around the truth 180 degrees. Another memo of Warren Commission attorney Norman Redlich to J. Lee Rankin dated February 28th, exactly a month later. During the course of yesterday's questioning of James Martin, that's the man with whom Marina Oswald moved in with and stayed right after the assassination, many questions were asked as to the character and personal life of Marina Oswald. James Martin stated that he had consciously attempted to create an image of Marina Oswald as a simple, devoted housewife who suffered at the hands of her husband and who's now filled with remorse for her husband's actions and deeply grateful for the generosity and the understanding of the American people. As Martin's testimony implicates, there's a strong possibility that Marina Oswald was, in fact, a very different person. She was cold, calculating, avaricious, scornful of generosity, and capable of a general lack of sympathy and personal relationship. The commission not only wants to determine who fired the shots that killed President Kennedy, but to study all the evidence that leads to the explanation of why the crime was committed. If Lee Harvey Oswald was the assassin, the character and personality of his wife must be considered relevant in our determination of the motive. There are many explanations for the assassination, but to the extent that we ignore any one possible explanation for the crime, we are focusing the attention of the commission and history on other motives, which may not be as sound as the ones we are going to ignore. This would be a disservice to the cause of truth, which, in your words, is our only client. Neither you nor I have the desire to smear the reputation of any individual. But we cannot ignore, however, that Marina Oswald has repeatedly lied to the Secret Service, the FBI, and the Warren Commission on matters of vital concern to the people of this country and to the world. And as you know, I was not in favor of placing on the record the story of her actions in Washington, but we already have statements which provide us with all we need to know on this matter. If any witness had close association with Marina Oswald and is prepared to offer certain insights into her character, including those of a derogatory nature, it is the mandate of the commission's inquiry that compels us to consider this testimony. August 22nd, Stuart Pollack, another attorney, wrote to Norman Redlich. As I indicated during the course of our conversation at noon yesterday, it seems to me that the absence of a section in the conspiracy chapter dealing with Marina Oswald is exceptionally obvious and a glaring gap in the character as it now stands. Although most people of the Warren Commission now assume a certain basic, if minimal, understanding of Marina and seem to feel there's no basis for believing her to be a secret agent of the Soviet government, the question of her status is one which most readers not only will be interested in, but look for in the report. It says there is no evidence of a Russian conspiracy. There's no indications of a Russian conspiracy here, but there is no adequate explanation to discuss people such as Michael Payne in that connection and fail to discuss the most obvious person in the category of possible accomplices, who is, of course, Marina. We're concerned about her personal problems with Oswald or bruises or general things that happened to her and Oswald. But they go on to say, in addition to Marina Oswald, what about after her arrival in the United States? He said there just seems to be no sign that she was a secret agent. Now, that part was absolutely untrue. It was written in August before they were going to press. Marina Oswald had contacts with the International Rescue Committee, run by Leo Chern, which was a CIA organization and known to be a CIA organization. She worked with Paul Rogatorowski's group in the Dallas-Fort Worth area and the Tolstoy Foundation, which was a violently anti-communist CIA foundation. She worked and lived with 20, 30 members of the Greek Orthodox Church that was a CIA foundation, admittedly a CIA front. From the time she came to America, she was with three known CIA organizations. Her first introduction to the Dallas-Fort Worth area was with two men of the CIA and the Solidaris, Mr. Lawrence Orloff and George de Morenschild, and then her contacts with Max Clark and George Bowie and Paul Rogatorowski, all of the Defense Industry Security Command and the CIA. Marina Oswald had contacts with engineers. Her translator, Mr. Mamontov, that was with her in the Dallas jail, was working with Army Intelligence and the CIA. Mr. Gregory, who was with her, was involved with the CIA. Marina Oswald's contact, Mr. John McVicker from the embassy in Moscow that arranged her papers to come to the United States, is described in the book Who's Who in CIA. Priscilla Johnson, who met Lee Harvey Oswald when he arrived in Moscow, has been written up in documents and in State Department papers as working with the State Department and CIA under the cover of being a journalist. In all of these areas, Marina Oswald's contacts were with the Central Intelligence Agency, and she was surrounded and threatened. James Hostie had to come to her November the 1st and threaten a citizenship or revoke her or ship her back. And Oswald knew that at the time. Lee Harvey Oswald knew that she had been threatened and put it in writing that he didn't trust the notorious FBI. Marina Oswald met with Priscilla Johnson, as I say, for 7 months in 1964, and Priscilla had all this information about Marina Oswald and kept it, knowing there were many critics about the assassination, the John Kennedy assassination, and then came out with this book at this strategic time like a time bomb. I have a document here I got from the National Archives. It's a correspondence of John J. McCloy, who was the attorney on the Warren Commission, one of the attorneys on the Warren Commission, members of the Warren Commission, attorney for Nelson Rockefeller and Chase Manhattan Bank. His address is 1 Chase, Manhattan. And in July 1964, he was writing about the chapter that he was supposed to put his name on in terms of Lee Harvey Oswald in the Soviet Union. John J. McCloy was given a document, page after page, about Lee Harvey Oswald's life in Russia, which is the area that involved Marina Oswald. And even McCloy, an attorney for the whole Cold War team, with working with Alan Dulles and John Foster Dulles and Nelson Rockefeller, couldn't stomach this chapter. So he sent a working letter of the chapter that he was supposed to be responsible for. And I have it here. It's the chapter, Lee Harvey Oswald's Life in Russia. And that's the section with Marina, dated July 2nd, 1964. And he has comments, the way the Warren Report was written. And his comments go like this. On page 7, he cites the page they've given him to sign. He has matters discussed. What proof is there for the assertion that Oswald had fixed timetables of activity? On page 7 or 8, he says, this factual information is not contained on these pages of Mrs. Oswald's testimony. Where is the documentation of Marina Oswald? On page 11, he says, the testimony of Mrs. Oswald indicates that she acquiesced to Lee's desires rather than accept his reasoning. Where is the proof? On page 17, how is it known whether Oswald denied himself any pleasures which are meaningful to him? Page 19, why inject the personal we? There's no reason to believe this story. Page 17, why is there no doubt he had a desire to be someone? What was his conception of his role in history? What documentation for these statements? You see, Marina Oswald and Priscilla Johnson are saying he wanted a role in history. On page 30, he says, why do you have remarks here that have no documentation on his attitude or use the word smilingly? He goes into page 67. What is your documentation of this part of Oswald in Russia? Page 68. What is the documentation of these sentences? On page 56, where is your documentation? 58. Where and to whom did Priscilla Johnson report her meetings with Oswald? And 59. What are the citations? Page 63. What friends and what documentation? On 55, he said, where is the comment for this? On page 69, he was to sign this chapter. Where's your documentation? 72. Where's your documentation? Page 92, 93. You have no documentation for these statements. This is the part that Priscilla Johnson and Marina Oswald put together in 64 as a chapter based on the Warren Report. And this is John J. McCloy refuting this story of Oswald in Russia. On page 94, he says, where's your documentation? 95, documentation. 98, documentation with a question mark. 99, documentation. Page 100, you have no documentation. Page 101, you have no documentation. Page 103 to 109 on Marina Oswald, where is your documentation about Marina Oswald and what she said? On page 109, is this statement correct that he escorted her to her home? There's no reference to taking Marina home after the second dance. Page 116, you have no documentation. Page 121 to 125, where is your documentation? 128, where is your documentation? 129 to 130, where is your documentation? This is challenging the Warren Report chapter that they went ahead and printed. This is written in July 28th, just a month before the set. The ink is being put to this Warren Report, and it's the basis of the book of Lee and Marina that Marina Oswald is supposed to put together, that Priscilla Johnson, the CIA agent, did. John J. McCloy is to put his name to this part of the chapter, and they're to get out a book which is getting the media, as I say, the Associated Press, United Press, Tom Snyder, Robert Hartman. They're pushing a woman, two women, on a thing that when it was put together, one of the most powerful attorneys in the United States didn't even have the evidence to support any of this. And this is why these women won't meet in talk shows or be challenged. Page 137, your documentation. Page 148, what do these records mean? Page 150, where's your documentation? On 150, again, he talks about the International Rescue Committee and their relationship to Lee and Marina. And 152, where's your documentation? And he goes on about Mrs. Marina Oswald. And there's great gaps, John J. McCloy says, in the documentation. It is understandable you may make educated guesses, but the Warren Commission has the responsibility of collecting and evaluating all the material for its final conclusions. And he said we should use available evidence and credible evidence. And it is missing in this chapter. The documentation is missing, and the citation gaps are missing. And that's even John J. McCloy in July of 1964. But the Warren Report was printed anyway. So now in 1977, we get a book by CIA agent Priscilla Johnson and CIA agent Marina Oswald pushing historic lies. I'm glad it sells for $15. A lot of people won't be able to afford it, but I assure you it'll be paperback, and it'll push, and they'll give it away, throw it away to disseminate some more lies to the American people. This is the kind of trash we serious researchers have had to face, but it makes us more angry and more convinced that we're on the right track, because the desperation of pumping this program zombie woman at this point is not only disgusting, but it makes us know all the more that we have to keep fighting to refute those lies. Well, this is Mae Bressel. Our time is up. Dialogue Conspiracy in Carmel, California. I'll see you next Sunday night, and take care until then.
You've been listening to Dialogue Conspiracy with Mae Brussel.
Maybe we're going to be right at the end of the week. Come on.